Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always illuminating to have a chance to visit with Dr. David Wormser, one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, for his perspectives on various facets of this war for the free world, particularly in his area of special expertise, the Middle East. But rarely more so than at the moment when there are some big things in the offing or taking place at the moment. David is a senior fellow and director of the Center for Security Policy's Project on Global Anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel Relationship. And he is also a former Middle East specialist for then Vice President Dick Cheney and has worked with Ambassador John Bolton in a number of capacities. He spent 11 years in the Naval Reserves working as an intelligence officer as well. Man of many parts, a great friend and resource. We're always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, David. Good to have you today.
Well, it's great to be back, Frank. Well,
it's especially important to do so as I'm anxious to get your take on what happened in the Israeli elections that took place this week. I know that some of this, as is always the case in Israel, is TBD, as they say, to be determined. Jockeying and coalition negotiations and so on will take some time. But what's the immediate upshot of what happened, as best you can tell at the moment?
Well, the immediate upshot is that there's no resolution as to a clean Israeli government that we can expect to take office in a few weeks is fully accepted and stable, a strong coalition. So the very first thing that we will face is we don't have a really clear new mandated Israeli government in front of us. And this comes from the nature of the political system there, where you have a parliament and there needs to be a coalition, therefore, of parties to make the government. And unfortunately for the prime minister, while he himself won the largest bloc, which is twice as large as any other bloc in the parliament, he doesn't have the required 61 seat majority in his coalition, clearly defined coalition, to stand up a government. So now he has to engage in this sausage making to create a new government. This is a messy process. It takes a long time. And in the last three rounds, it didn't end very decisively and conclusively, leading to this to be the fourth election in 2 years. So this is where we are, and we're still in this messy period, unfortunately.
This comes at a bad time, it seems, because, among other things, the Biden administration is seemingly absolutely insistent on enabling Israel's mortal enemy, Iran, to become a nuclear weapon state and a much more dangerous force in the region. We'll talk more about that in our second block with you. But David, it's been true for several years now that Israel has needed a stable government that could deal decisively with these sorts of threats. It hasn't had that. It's muddled through. Bibi has been the prime minister throughout, but as you say, he has had to engage in endless negotiations with these various caterwauling coalition partners and seen successive governments collapse because of their lack of, you know, this kind of coherence. This is also happening at a moment when he is being prosecuted for corrupt activities and supposed to go on trial, as I understand it, on the 4th of April. How do these various forces affect the prospect of getting a coalition that will somehow be more stable, somehow be more coherent, somehow be more conducive to addressing the challenges Israel faces at the moment?
Well, unfortunately, I think it has a deleterious effect on the ability to form a coalition because so many of the people who lead the other parties are expecting him to be he's going to be put on trial very soon for some of these corruption charges, all of which seem to be a rather thin reed. So they may amount to nothing in the end. But in politics, that's all you need sometimes to balk. And that's exactly what's happening with a lot of these parties. They're sort of taking a wait and see attitude. It also opens the door for some of them to pass a law saying that a senior official who's been indicted, not convicted, mind you, but indicted, cannot stand for elections. The problem with that law then means that everybody will wait for this round of negotiations for coalition forming to fail, and Israel would go for fifth elections, but then they can pass the law to bar him from running. So it all becomes a political game here, and it leads to a great deal of instability and unpredictability. There's more factors here than simply standing up a government. It's who leads the right, getting rid of Netanyahu, etc. And there's so many mechanisms at work that nobody, even the best political hack in Israel right now, can't quite figure out how this is all going to play out.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this that is deeply troubling to me. When we spoke with our colleague Carolyn Glick, another wonderful senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, earlier, the day of the elections, as a matter of fact, she was fairly clear that one of the factors in all of this mayhem, if I can use that expression to describe Israeli politics, I think it's apt, was interference by the United States government in the election. Did you see evidence of that, David? And if so, what's up with that? Not only is this a close ally of the United States, of course, but we've been fairly insistent that people shouldn't be interfering in our elections, though there's evidence that they have for some time. Where do we get off doing that to Israel?
Going back at least a half decade or more, really going back to the Clinton administration, there have been successive and growing attempts by the United States to try to influence and redirect the course of Israeli elections. It started under when Ambassador Martin Indyk under President Clinton was there, when he worked to organize the Arab vote into a coherent vote that challenges the structure of Israeli politics. Now, Israeli Arabs have a full right to vote, and they always have, and they've exercised that vote, and they have a fairly powerful bloc to do so. But what he was doing was organizing busing and other things to get Arabs to the voting booth. In other words, spending money, U.S. government money, to ensure that there's a disproportionate amount of the Arab vote out there. Now, this has only increased. In 2015, we had a V15 movement, which was entirely funded, apparently, through U.S. government money to try to swing the elections against the prime minister, the same prime minister as is currently Prime Minister Netanyahu. There was tens of millions of dollars spent to swing elections, including canvassing and distorting the canvassing, distorting the actual, campaigning door to door.
In other words, direct interference. David, hold the thought, because I want to come back to this briefly. We have to take a short break, and we will be right back with more about the Israeli elections, what it means for us, this outcome, and what it means for the region as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy, one of our duty experts on the Middle East. He was describing U.S. interference in the Israeli elections that have just been concluded inconclusively, alas. And David, you were talking about several different things that clearly are an affront, it seems to me, especially where U.S. taxpayer dollars are being used for partisan purposes to try to undermine the elected prime minister of Israel and otherwise affect electoral outcomes there. Finish your thought.
Yeah, I mean, they're more than an affront. They're also illegal. We can't use government money for political purposes inside Israel or really any other democracy. This trend that you've seen over the last 20, 30 years, starting with the Clinton administration, to distort Israeli politics really took a dangerous, much more dangerous turn in this round. When you started seeing the attempt to Americanize the Israeli elections, bring to Israel the same sort of shenanigans and difficulties and problems that we have here. In fact, one of the main players here was the Lincoln Project. And lo and behold, they show up in Israel in an attempt to split the right, exactly like they did here, is to try to peel away some of the conservative side to try to weaken them. And that's exactly what happened here. So the Lincoln Project didn't really succeed very well because the right, that centrist right that they tried to pull over, essentially collapsed in the final vote. But they still have enough seats to block a coalition. So, again, it's a great interference. By the way, you see a tremendous amount of interference also from the Europeans. So there's direct and indirect U.S. interference, some directly by us, some through the Europeans. But in the end, it distorted Israeli politics. And that's one of the reasons why we have such a... And it's very disturbing because our foreign policy is ostensibly based on hoping for human rights and freedom. And here's a policy that's very cynical. We're putting democracy and freedom and the integrity of Israeli democracy at a far lower priority than our obsessive pursuit of a peace process along concepts that have been tried and failed for 40, 50 years.
Well, I want to bring us to that very topic, David Wormser. There is a report out of the United Arab Emirates national newspaper that the United States administration is now working hard to breathe new life into the so-called peace process, specifically by reversing a number of policies that Donald Trump had taken, aimed at really trying to respond to the unproductive, unconstructive role that the so-called Palestinian leadership had been playing for many years. Talk a little bit about what we are hearing with respect to this idea that we want to start putting a lot of American taxpayer money into the Palestinian leadership and cause and jumpstart anew the so-called two-state solution peace process. Specifically, is there a Palestinian leadership with whom we can do so? To your way of thinking, and what are the implications of trying to get all this going before there's an election taking place there at last, I believe in May?
Well, I think we're already trying to influence that election. What's happened is that with the peace treaty, not the peace process, but the actual peace treaty that was signed between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, it opens up a tremendous opportunity for the infusion of Arab investment and money into the Arab sector, that is external Arab money and investment into the Arab sector to cause development and to help foster a new leadership, something that the prime minister has been working with the UAE to do. And this, of course, is a...
When you say the Arab sector, you mean the Arab population inside Israel?
Inside probably. Israel, but it's also a model for the Arab sector, the Palestinian community outside of Israel's recognized the ceasefire lines from 1967, what people call the Green Line. So it's a model to try to help reshape Palestinian politics. And in the Arab community now, in this election, you actually saw a trend underneath that's very positive and very good, which was to encourage the Arabs to stop with their nationalist, we are Palestinians, not Israelis, and so forth, message, which was giving them nothing. Their anti-Zionist call for Israel's destruction made them untouchable politically, which made their community disenfranchised politically. What you're seeing now is a lot of Arabs in Israel, partly because of the UAE's peace treaty with Israel, say, enough with this. We just want to live our lives. We're Israelis. We're accepting that. We just need crime dealt with, social issues dealt with, and real bread and butter issues dealt with. So you're seeing the normalization of Israeli politics. And with this big initiative by the United States, in some ways, it's to try to block the UAE. It's an attempt to essentially not forgive the UAE for having made peace without the Palestinian radical leadership that exists. And as a result, we've taken measures to try to torpedo and sabotage this effort, including stopping a trip by Prime Minister Netanyahu to the UAE last month and so forth. Now comes out that we're unveiling, there's serious discussion internally in the administration about a new initiative. Some of those measures seem to be designed to take down Israel a couple notches, which is interesting because that's what President Obama once said was the problem, is that Israel's too strong, Israel's too well off, Israel's too functioning as a society, needs to be taken down a couple notches to incentivize them to give in. And what you see in the proposals which are being put forward in the State Department, one of the provisions of it is to relabel things coming from the, quote, the West Bank as not Israeli product. It's a structure the Europeans have been pushing for that essentially opens the door for a boycott of Israeli products, because it's going to be very difficult to avoid a boycott of almost all Israeli products by labeling those from the West Bank. Why? Because every single Israeli bank, for example, has a branch in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, where everybody sees these pictures of Jews praying at the Western Wall, according to this definition of Israel, that is not part of Israel. That is occupied territory. They're going back to the UN resolution of 5 years ago under Obama, which means every bank in Israel is violating the terms and needs to be labeled as violating this, and should be labeled on, i.e. boycotted. Well, if every Israeli bank is boycotted and every Israeli business that has a branch or even employees that come from the West Bank, you can imagine how universal eventually this boycott becomes. So this is really an opening door for the BDS movement, the Boycott the Sanctions movement against Israel, not a peace process.
Hard to imagine a more direct affront to the idea that Israel is a vital strategic ally of the United States, and its security and ours are tied and need to be mutually supportive. This is deeply troubling, David. And again, as I said earlier, this is coming at the same time that the administration is actively seeking to curry favor with the Iranians, which is, among other things, resulting in a whole spate of new attacks from Yemen by the Iranians' proxies there, the Houthi terrorist organization, now recently de-designated as a terrorist organization as part of this campaign by the Biden team. Talk very quickly, if you would, about how strengthening or seemingly seeking to strengthen our enemies at the same time that we are clearly weakening our friends is likely to net out in terms of vital U.S. national security interests.
Well, at the same time, we're considering a boycott and sanction type activity against one of our allies. Boycott and sanction, by the way, is an act of war. So it's essentially declaring war on one of our allies. We're lifting sanctions and lifting and encouraging our allies to release monies to Tehran so that they can further fund their regional activities, threatening our position and our soldiers all across the region, let alone our allies. So it's really an inverted foreign policy. We are trying to strengthen our enemies at the cost of our allies. Supposedly, I would imagine they justify it as an idea that it can encourage them to make peace and be more moderate. Again, something that has a track record of zero success, despite having been tried numerous times. But still, that is our policy. And what you see, the Iranians are taking it to the bank and running with it. They're increasing their activity in Yemen against Saudi Arabia. They're threatening Israel from Yemen now,
including physical attacks on Saudi oil facilities and infrastructure and the like. Yeah. David, this brings me to one quick point, and we have to leave it at this, I'm afraid. But this recent incident in the Suez Canal, in which a huge cargo vessel has blocked it for days now, impacting lots of the traffic that uses that canal every single day. This has obviously not been lost on those in the region, including, of course, the Iranians, as to what damage could be done by obstructing not only that particular important artery, but the Strait of Hormuz. When you look at this, it all seems to net out to a region that is becoming more dangerous, not less, under the Biden-Harris team's ministry.
It is. I think exactly something. This may be an accident. It seems to be an accident in the Suez Canal, but an accident gives ideas to people who shouldn't be given ideas. And that's exactly what will happen now. As you'll see now, an effort by terrorists to use strategic choke points, canals, either Panama or the Suez Canal, and try to kill them off by sinking a ship in them or something like that. So I can imagine now an increase in attempts to attack strategic lines of sea lanes of communication or strategic lanes of communication.
This is a topic to which we have to return, David. We are hard out of time. I want to say thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy, as well as your past service to our country. It's deeply appreciated and incredibly interesting, and we look forward to visiting with you more about all of this next week. Next up, we'll speak with Charles Sam Faddis, former undercover operative, about the state of spying in our country, among other things, and what it might mean for you. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and I'm delighted to say the same to our next guest. He is Sam Faddis, a former operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, undercover in its clandestine services, a former Army officer, a former Assistant Attorney General in Washington State, a former candidate for the Congress of the United States, and a terrific author of both fiction and nonfiction works, including, in the latter category, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. These days, he is writing prolifically for a terrific online resource, andmagazine.com, which I commend to all of you, in the course of which he has laid out some very interesting insights into topics that I think demand our attention. We're going to talk with him about them today. Sam, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
First up, you brought to my attention for the first time, and I think I'm following this fairly closely, an important fact concerning this murderous attack in Boulder, Colorado, a couple of days ago. We've learned, not immediately, of course, but eventually, about the nature of the individual who did the shooting. But honestly, I hadn't seen it until you wrote it up. The nature of the place that he shot up. Talk a little bit about both of those, if you would, and how this is really being used politically by the left in a way that is, not surprising necessarily, but shocking nonetheless.
Right. Well, the grocery store in question, King Super, I think is the name in Boulder. Overall, I think it's actually owned by the Kroger Corporation, but that particular store bills itself as a kosher deli. For the Jewish community. I mean, specifically represents itself that way, markets itself that way, and is known that way. If you go online and look at that store, local Jewish associations offer special discounts if you shop there. It's described as a neighborhood store. The local Jewish community paper in Boulder after the shooting talks extensively about how the place, what a blow it is to the community that their grocery store, that's their verbiage, not mine, was shot up. So what we have is a guy who is a Muslim who appears to have had some real anger issues and identified with Islamic extremism, who walked into a Jewish grocery store, in essence, and shot it up. That's the real story, but yet, as you say, you could read 100, probably 1,000 articles on this attack and not see a single reference to the nature of the target he attacked.
Well, it was hard to get out the idea that this fellow may actually have been a jihadist, point one. But when you learn the nature of the target, it becomes that much more obvious what really was going on here, although it flew in the face of the insistence of many in the media and elsewhere that this was a white supremacist attack, evidence that we have this horrific and vast domestic terrorism problem emanating from that quarter. And Sam, I mean, you're a serious national security professional and practitioner. When you see this kind of dissembling, deception, disinformation, deflection, whatever you want to call it, it seems as though its object is at least in part to keep us witless about the true nature of enemies that we find here at home. And you've done an enormous amount of work over the past few years as well on the Antifa and Black Lives Matter organization and the kind of terrorism in which they've engaged. Again, often very, well, shall we say, inadequately reported or addressed by politicians of the left and to some extent even of the right. What is going on here, as you see it? What's animating this kind of effort to dumb down our situational awareness, as the military would say?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the short answer is that all of this is propaganda. I mean, what you're being fed is, you got to, you know, at least a couple of factors at work. One is you're being told a bunch of things that are outright lies. And secondly, you're just simply not being told a lot of things that are manifestly true. So you can burn every major city in the United States and cause billions of dollars in damage, and yet have the media just simply say that that didn't really happen. There were mostly peaceful protests, and anything that happened was around the margins. That's before we get to the part where you're probably told, and if anything did happen, you deserved it. And then you can have a handful of guys break some windows and assault police officers at the Capitol. Again, I'm not condoning any of that. And seriously be told that we have to call in the United States Army and there's a domestic insurrection going on and white supremacists are the major threat. I mean, it's, you know, this is literally propaganda. And what really terrifies me about it is not just the news media, which is already horrifying enough, but now we see the complicity of our intelligence agencies. I mean, we see the Director of National Intelligence issuing supposed intel assessments that are nonsensical. I mean, they'd be laughable, except, oh my God, people actually take them seriously, telling us, don't fear the Chinese, but oh my God, those Russians are back. You know, this kind of silliness.
Well, that brings me to the question of Avril Haines, the Director of National Intelligence. You've written about her, again, in a way that was highly illuminating, I found, under the heading, "Whatever she is, she's not a spy." Talk us through that. I mean, this started with your sort of analysis of recent and deeply problematic National Intelligence Directorate report, professing to be, you know, from the intelligence community writ large. But maybe start with the individual who is sitting atop that organization, this guy, Avril Haines.
Right. So Avril, you know, is now the Director of National Intelligence and regularly referred to as our top spy, as if we should pay some attention to what she thinks. She was, until up till relatively recently, before she went to law school, she used to run an independent bookstore down in the Fells Point area, I think, of Baltimore, where she and her husband specialized in having readings of erotic literature. Then she decided at some point she was going to law school. She went to law school. She got a handful of jobs in relatively rapid succession in D.C., junior level attorney type positions, until she ends up being on the staff of the committee. This is back before Biden was vice president, when that Biden was on as a senator, and makes that connection. And from there, boom. I mean, the next thing you know, she's the number two person in the Central Intelligence Agency. Literally, she becomes the deputy national security advisor in the Obama White House. No national security experience, no intelligence experience, no military experience. And by the way, of course, along in this, she is up to her neck in the entire Spygate thing, when all of the critical things are happening in the White House regarding the allegation against Donald Trump. She, in fact, chairs many of those meetings. And now she's your director of national intelligence, so she has no qualifications whatsoever for that job, other than she politically attached herself to Joe Biden, frankly, not that many years ago. So why anybody would pay any attention to Avril Haines' judgment on anything, I have no idea. I mean, she has not a clue what she's talking about.
Well, and what she is talking about is worrying as well. And what we are imputing to her in terms of authority is therefore that much more worrying. Sam, again, you've spent much of your professional life in and around the intelligence business. What are the implications of having someone who seemingly not only is not qualified for this position, but is basically there because of simply political connections and some service of a very political character that is really worrying, specifically the whole Spygate implications or complicity, I should say, that she seems to have.
And well, I mean, I think we've already seen the dangers of this, right? It's not just propaganda and spin and disinformation, not that those things aren't critical, but, you know, we've seen people like General Flynn criminally prosecuted and the government attempting to imprison him based on political motivation. There's no other way to put it. Whatever he did, he didn't engage in any criminal offenses. And that's really where we are. We're sitting here at this point, which is almost unbelievable, in the United States of America, where we have a party that has taken, is using the intelligence and law enforcement communities, weaponizing them against political opponents. This is the kind of stuff we used to ridicule other nations for, consider absurd that, you know, the president will have all his opponents locked up and sent off to prison. We're standing right on the doorstep. We're standing right on the cusp of literally seeing exactly that happen in the United States of America.
It's banana republic time. But as you say, the stakes are infinitely higher because this country is, after all, the last best hope of mankind. And if we go down that road, there's going to be precious little left of the free world, I'm afraid. And that's precisely the idea, it seems. Sam Faddis, you do incredibly important work in analyzing all of these things, documenting them, and bringing them to our attention at andmagazine.com and on our programs here at Secure Freedom Radio and our television program, Securing America. We're very grateful for your service in those capacities, as well as at the Committee on the Present Danger, China. And I want to commend in particular a project to which you are contributing called the Accountability Initiative. You can find it at theaccountabilityinitiative.com. It is making book on many of these personnel choices of the Biden-Harris administration, and it's vital reading, and I only pray that members of the United States Senate will be paying close attention to them before they confirm any more of these appointees. Thank you, sir, for your time today. As always, come back to us again next week if you would. Next up, we will speak with Lance Crayon, remarkable source on Chinese disinformation and influence operations.
About go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are going to visit in this block with a very interesting man who I've recently made the acquaintance of, and we've talked with him once or twice on air to date, but he's a source of insight into a piece of the problem that we face with communist China that is generally, well, ill understood at best and ignored by many. That is the Chinese Communist Party's influence operations and propaganda inside the United States. His name is Lance Crayon. He knows whereof he speaks because, for a time, he worked inside the belly of the beast, some of the Chinese propaganda instruments in Beijing and in Los Angeles, and has, as a result, some insights from his time with China Radio, China Daily, and Global Times about what they and their sister organizations, including an outfit that has come to be somewhat notorious, the Confucius Institutes, have been up to trying to essentially manipulate American public opinion, attitudes, and policies towards the People's Republic of China. It's always good to have a chance to visit with him. Lance Cran, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk first and foremost about your understanding of the role that these Confucius Institutes play, not only at the university level, but on down through K through 12, in essentially trying to, as I say, manipulate American young people's attitudes towards, understanding of, and likely sort of preferences about the Chinese Communist Party.
I think they operate on two levels. One is about money and the influence that that carries. And then two, it's the influence, it's the propaganda influence shaping young American minds, young impressionable minds through K through 12 and obviously in college, of course. So it works on the right hand is money. The left hand is mental. Get inside their head and really influence and ingrain what they want, how they want China to be perceived. So they start with the younger generations.
This is generally packaged as language instruction, and yet it turns out that there's a lot more to it. So much so that it has begun to get some significant attention from Congress and from some, at least in the media. The Trump administration decided to crack down on some of these operations. The Biden administration, not so much. One of the things that the Chinese have done in response is, try to rebrand the whole operation. What's up with that, Lance?
That's a very common Chinese move to change the name, especially with any foreign presence they have. And they're changing the name to the Center for Language Education and Cooperation. They announced this initiative last July, actually, and it's recently fallen back into the spotlight here in America because they officially changed the name of their U.S. headquarters in D.C. Originally, when this was announced in July, this is interesting, it was going to be the Ministry of Education Center for Language Education Cooperation. So they dropped Ministry of Education, which definitely would have been more nefarious because that's Chinese government as opposed to an NGO. Center for Language Education Cooperation is what it's now going to be called. And I think the U.S. initiative in regards to waking up America is certainly long overdue. I mean, Confucius Institute, they've been around, I think it was 2003, is when they opened their first one. So this is long overdue.
And they've had over 100 of them operating on U.S. college campuses. And what we've learned is that money that you talked about has tended to buy support from the academic institutions in question, whether they're at the university level or below, and enable the Confucius Institutes, under whatever name they call themselves, to have influence well beyond just the curricula to which these kids are being exposed. Talk, if you would, Lance, about how the money, how these centers, how these agendas have enabled the Chinese Communist Party to actually dictate, in some cases at least, who is allowed to teach and who is allowed to even speak on college campuses. A pretty extensive degree of influence, I would say.
Yes, and what they do is they'll target small schools, second-tier and third-tier universities. And if they'll say, hey, if you open up a Confucius Institute on your campus, we'll funnel Chinese students to you. For someone from the Chinese mainland, for a student from the Chinese mainland to go to school in America, they have to be approved. Every visa is approved. And for a student who's applying to a school that doesn't have a Confucius Institute, or I should say a Center for Language Education Cooperation now, the school doesn't have it versus the school that does have one, the Chinese government will give approval to the school that does have the language institute.
And the value of that to these schools is that those Chinese students tend to pay full freight. So it's another source of revenue for the academic institutions, right?
Yeah, international students pay upwards of three times the average state rate. So that, and that's just tuition alone. So you've got housing and everything else, and then the parents usually will come and visit. So that's a lot of money coming into the local economy, not just the university as well.
Let me switch gears with you, Lance, because this is a very troubling aspect of what the Chinese are doing. But something else that's also concerning is the hard lesson that the Chinese are teaching a prominent retailer called H&M, with a view to obviously getting the attention of a lot of other companies that are either doing business in China or are doing business, at least with the Chinese. Give us a little bit of the flavor of what's been going on with this outfit, H&M, in China.
Sure. They announced to clean, basically scrub all the websites of H&M products. H&M had a huge presence in China. They had over 500 brick-and-mortar stores. Last March of 2020, they made some comments about how they don't purchase their cotton from Xinjiang, which is China's largest cotton producing center, due to forced labor and human rights violations and that sort of thing with Xinjiang. But China didn't really react.
The genocide that's taking place there, in fact, as well as slave labor. Yeah,
exactly. And so China didn't react. This comment, these quotes have been around, I guess, obviously for a year. But in response to the recent sanctions released by the U.S. and the EU on Monday, China's going to play this card. They say, okay, H&M, you're out. And which is scary because it's scary on many levels, but really what it is, the Chinese expression, kill the chicken to scare the monkey. H&M was actually, in March of last year, it began to go down in China. Like they were down like 84% total in sales. They were closing stores. China didn't pick the biggest target, but they're making them an example for their bigger targets. Say, hey, this is what we can do. Within 24 hours, less than that, immediately, Alibaba and all the retail website platforms, there was nothing. They weren't selling H&M. Like, it was amazing. Like, within an hour,
it had been disappeared.
It disappeared, exactly.
Clearly a function of the state deciding that they were going to take it out. And the point here is that a lesson is being learned, presumably, by American and other companies, I imagine European ones as well, that they better toe the party line and continue to use the products out of Xinjiang, whether it's done by forced labor or otherwise.
Yeah, and what's really another thing that's scary about this initiative against H&M, is how Global Times came out and said yesterday that H&M remarks were suicidal, but the remarks were made a year ago. So how China will play this card aimed at a company, the sanctions that released by the U.S. and the EU were directed at individuals. So one person, a total of maybe, I think, 10 this week, and before the Alaska talks, there was like five. So China has decided to respond. Instead of placing sanctions against U.S. officials or European officials, which they did a little bit, they're gonna hit a business, a national chain, an international retail chain.
And another interesting point out of what you've just said is, of course, the degree to which Chinese companies, ostensibly private entities like Alibaba, actually are using or being used as instruments of the state as well. This is a point that shouldn't be lost on American investors who are encouraged to put money into outfits like Alibaba. It's basically just another arm of the Chinese Communist Party. Lance Cran, fascinating insights into what is the nature of the Chinese Communist regime and how it is increasingly aggressively operating against the United States. We appreciate your expertise as well as your experience with these characters, and we look forward to visiting with you about them further in the future. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.